Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with General William Odom, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He's also an adjunct professor at Yale University. He was the director of the National Security Agency under President Ronald Reagan from 1985 to 1988, responsible for the nation's signals intelligence and communication security. And from 1981 to 1985, he served as the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, the Army's senior intelligence officer. And from 1977 to 1981, General Odom was military assistant to the President's Assistant for National Security Affairs, Zbigniew Brzezinski. Earlier this month, a week ago, on April the 2nd, he presented testimony advocating a rapid withdrawal of American troops from Iraq to the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. Of course, later they heard the testimony of General Petraeus, which we'll talk about. Then we'll go to Lawrence O'Donnell, who is the MSNBC senior political analyst and the panelist on the McLaughlin Group. He's also an Emmy Award-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing and a former contributing editor to New York Magazine and a former Democratic Chief of Staff of the United States Senate Committee on Finance and for the United States Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. Mr. O'Donnell has a new piece out that's in the Huffington Post and in the New York Magazine, which foresees a possible nightmarish deadlocked Democratic convention in Colorado. And then in the third segment of the first hour, we'll speak with Judith Todd, who's a human rights activist and author who was born and raised in what is now Zimbabwe. She became a heroine of the struggle to liberate Rhodesia from the minority white supremacist rule of Ian Smith. And for her efforts, she was jailed by Smith in 1972 and then forced out of the country to spend 8 years in exile. She returned to Zimbabwe shortly before independence was achieved in 1980 and had a front row view from her position as director of an international aid agency to the disaster that Robert Mugabe's regime became. Her new book, picked by The Economist as a book of the year, Through the Darkness, A Life in Zimbabwe. And we're talking to her. I'm now speaking with General William Odom, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He's also an adjunct professor at Yale University and was director of the National Security Agency under President Ronald Reagan from 85 to 88. And he's also served from 81 to 85 as the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, the Army's senior intelligence officer. And from 1977 to 1981, General Odom was the military assistant to the President's Assistant for National Security Affairs, Zbigniew Brzezinski. And just on April the 2nd, recently, General Odom testified to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee advocating a rapid withdrawal of American troops from Iraq, and that was preceding the testimony of General Petraeus. And General Odom, it is extraordinary I think it's pretty clear, is it not, that the President of the United States doesn't really have a strategy. His only strategy, it appears to be, is to pass this mess off to his successor. Why do you think that nobody in those hearings, particularly on the Democratic side, pointed that out?
I really don't know. They were tougher on the witness this time than they were last time. In fact, I had word in advance that Petraeus and Crocker would be more or less given a pass this time. And if you heard those hearings, you can see that even Republicans were really disappointed and made no bones about expressing it.
Well, in a perfect world or a fair world, I would suggest that it should have been President Bush who was sitting at that witness table.
Well, that's been the game he's played all along rather successfully, and that's to fall back and say, I do what my commanders tell me, you should listen to them. Which is a way to dodge responsibility. I pointed that out in a radio talk response to one of his Saturday morning talks about a year ago, which I said he's essentially absent without leave. After all, he's supposed to be calling his shots in Iraq, not asking somebody else out there to call them for him. Now, he certainly needs a lot of staffing advice from out there. Finally, he is the person who answers to the public on this, and I think he really ought to be up front on it.
Well, in your testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, prior to General Petraeus's testimony, you said those who link instability with a U.S. withdrawal have it exactly backwards. And that seems to be the Gordian knot. Could you just briefly outline your argument?
Well, a simple way to understand it is to look at the public opinion polling. Even in Anbar province, where lots of Sunni local leaders, sheikhs, other strongmen, have rented their services to the U.S. Army, and this is praised as a great success in lowering the violence and achieving political stability. 70% of the population out there recently said in a poll that no political reconciliation could be achieved as long as U.S. forces are there. I think that kind of says it all. That's been more or less the case all along. There are a number of reasons for that. I don't think any government can attain legitimacy with the Iraqi population as long as it depends on the U.S. government or has any U.S. military forces present. I also think that as long as they're there, we're preventing the inevitable civil wars that are already occurring and must be finished. We're preventing them from coming to a conclusion to decide who's going to rule. And I'm also reasonably sure that the government now inside the Green Zone, the formal government, will not be the party or the group that wins the final leadership role in this country. They have to be in that Green Zone because they don't have the security and the support to be outside. The leaders who will eventually run the country are out taking care of themselves.
Well, I think a lot of them, at least in terms of the Shiites, are in Iran, including Sadr, who seems...
Well, Sistani's not there.
Right, but...
I don't think... Yes, that's true to some degree, but even if that could be true, and I wouldn't... I don't think there's a reason for changing my mind on it.
No, but I think that if, for example, the dean of the diplomatic corps, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, basically says that the United States has an unsuccessful military occupation in Iraq, whereas Iran has a successful political occupation. And it does seem that while we're failing to bring stability, Iran seems to be the only people that can broker any deals.
I think I have great respect for Chaz Freeman, and he certainly knows this area well. I'm more cautious about what I believe the Iranians can achieve. They have success there in large part because we are there. Iraq invaded them under Saddam's rule in 1980, and for the next 8 years, they had one of the bloodiest wars in the history of either country in modern times. Literally hundreds of thousands of casualties dead. Many, many teenage Iranians were killed in it. And it still is a great trauma for those societies. Persians look down on Arabs, and Arabs don't like Persians. The Shiite religion, I don't think, trumps that divide except when it's convenient or one side or the other. While we're there, it's more convenient. Were we to get out, I think the Iranian influence would fall precipitously.
Well, one of the ironies you point out in your testimony, General Odom, was that Al-Qaeda's public diplomacy campaign for the past year or so on the internet, they implore the United States to bomb and invade Iran and destroy this apostate Shiite regime, which in a sense puts our vice president and some members of the Senate in alignment with Al-Qaeda on spreading the war to Iran.
Yes, I did, and I must say I'm puzzled that they don't seem to realize that. I took the opportunity to call it to their attention. I don't know whether it's going to have any impact on how they stand on this issue, but it ought to give us all pause to see that kind of alignment among our leaders with our reported to be deadly enemy.
So I just in terms of the politics of the moment, given that this is an election year, you know, you might ask that having made us less strong, less safe, and less free, with an economy in free fall and a lost war in Iraq about to blow up in their faces, how could the Bush administration get away with it?
Well, the Congress and the public have let him do it. And, you know, after all, a large part of the population has, over a period of the last several years, supported the Bush policy. We have to acknowledge that. As long as a large number of Americans will abide it, we'll continue it.
Do you think that there is a sort of silent majority out there that John McCain is tapping into that simply just don't want to swallow defeat? They can't believe that this group of religious zealots could basically defeat the United States? Is that what the McCain campaign is going to be about?
It looks that way. I mean, if you take where he is today, you'd have to say that looks probable. But I suspect McCain has taken that hard line as a nomination tactic, because the largest number of those people holding that view are in have been in that camp, at least as far as I know about the public opinion polls. And he needs them to get the nomination. Whether he needs them to get elected is another matter. So I don't know what his final position will be, but public opinion polling of late has suggested a very strong majority for getting out and getting out soon.
But somehow the Democratic candidates can't turn that to their advantage, it appears, that they are still essentially stuck with George W. Bush's mistake having become their problem.
Yes, and many of them are sort of gun-shy of being called soft on national security. And they haven't been very articulate or very convincing in telling the public that it's not in our national security interest to do what we're doing. I think it should be fairly easy to articulate the reasons why. A lot of them don't seem to think they have the credibility to do it. They have more veterans in the Congress than the Republicans do. If you're looking at the people who have more military experience in the Congress, strangely, the Democrats outnumber the Republicans appreciably. So you've got that strange factor, too. I don't have any solution for it. I'm not an expert on American politics.
But you are, you were able to tell the Senate in advance of the Petraeus hearings some of the realities, and particularly where this policy is really going, not in terms of the promises, but in terms of the actual on-the-ground facts that have followed this so-called surge, which, as you point out in your testimony, for years prior to that, the Sunnis were offering this deal, and Tony Blair tried to broker it earlier, but eventually we sort of made a deal with the devil, did we not?
Well, yes, I've said that, and I've said it earlier other times and repeatedly, but I must say I can't give myself a very good record for point out a good record for changing anybody's mind on this in the administration or key leaders of the Congress as far as actions they're willing to take. You know, they've sort of taken the view that if they pass a bill for funding defense, funding the troops in Iraq, and they don't do what the president wants in that bill, then he'll just veto it. Now, they'll be left looking like they don't support the troops. I don't know why they don't simply make the argument that supporting the troops is bringing them home, not leaving them out there, and say that very repeatedly. And also, if instead of giving the president the opportunity to veto, why don't they just simply refuse to pass a bill of any kind? And the money will run out, and Mr. Bush will have to come back and to them to get it. And it seems to me that puts them in the catbird seat. Now, that's a pretty bold step. They would have to trust that they could explain to a lot of Americans who may not immediately understand why it is in the troops' interest, but I think those who talk to many of the troops would find the troops wouldn't be against it for the most part. There might be some. But they've got that option, and they haven't acted on it. So I think there's still some calling to account of our Congress and both parties, and particularly the Democratic Party, for not exercising the options they really have.
But at this point, it appears to be cynical. I mean, I'm talking about the administration's position here. The New York Times on Sunday in their editorial said that Mr. Bush's capacity for denial is limitless. I can't believe that this is all about his denial, because I'm sure somebody's told him somewhere how bad things are in Iraq. He can't be that much in a cocoon, in a bubble, surely. And if he knows how bad things really are, then he's really not in denial. He's a coward. He just doesn't want to admit that he's made a terrible mistake, and he's handing this mistake off to his successor, because even John McCain said recently, he retracted his straight talk when he said that if the surge doesn't work in Iraq, he'll lose the election. So I mean, again, it gets you back to what seems to be pretty obvious here, is that the strategy is to play this thing out, to kick the can down the road and hope that it doesn't blow up in their faces until after the election.
Well, you can certainly draw that conclusion, and I'm not going to try to discourage you from doing that. I mean, it's a very compelling argument in light of the facts. It's just a hard conclusion, a hard inference to get around.
Well, you'd think that it'd be in the interest of the Democrats to lay down that marker.
Quite true. Quite true. Maybe we'll see one of them do that. You know, there's some time to do that. I've been a little surprised at the way the Democrats let the thing move the debate in their nominating process, move the debate to the economy only. Certainly, it's got to move the economy. But a great part of the reason the economy's in trouble is the enormous amount of deficit spending. I was struck when I testified up there, absolutely surprised to hear a Republican Senator Voinovich from Ohio pull out the data on how we funded the war and what kind of deficits we're creating and the pressure for future inflation. The way the public is supporting the troops is just running the printing presses, making no sacrifice whatsoever. So when you people out there in the public don't call the Congress to account when they are frightened when the president says, oh, we've got to support the troops, and what he's really recommending is that they just print this money like Monopoly money, and it's just passing on the debt to you in the future. I don't know when it'll be paid. Maybe some of us will escape it, but it's just absolute self-deception, the game we're playing on that. And I have talked to some soldiers, officers, who've been home and recognize this and are just astounded. They're astounded, completely out of touch, how out of touch the American public is, although it claims to be all that concerned about the troops.
Well, clearly we're maxing out our grandchildren's credit cards here, and you'd think that the average voter would find it rather a good argument that how come we're filling potholes in Baghdad and not in Main Street USA? But again, I'm not sure who's making those arguments.
Well, you don't hear them. I think I've heard one or two comments that in the Democratic primaries, but it certainly hasn't been the theme, seems to me it could be.
Hmm. Well, just in closing, General Odom, given your career as an Army officer, having been head of Army Intelligence, I understand in the military, the chain of command is fairly sacred, and one of the things that I'm surprised about the kid glove treatment that General Petraeus has been given by the press is that nobody's pointed out there's a lot of rumors in the Pentagon Admiral Fallon basically quit because Petraeus essentially stabbed him in the back and had a direct line to the president, cut him out of the chain of command, and left him sort of twisting in the wind, which is not exactly a noble thing to do.
Well, I don't know if the evidence is complete on that story or exactly how to judge it. I'd want to hear more. I want to hear Fallon's story in public. I've seen reporting only today that suggested that Fallon really, rather than understanding the real issues, really was not very effective in what he was doing. And if that's true, then he might not fare well in a public airing of all the details on it. But again, if he's really offered prudent and well-placed and well-informed advice, and he's been run out for it, then it would be nice for the public to know, and particularly nice for the Congress, who accepts these testimonies as if they're the unvarnished truth.
Well, just in closing then, do you feel that that the how would you just compare this particular hearing to the last one? It seems that this time around he was Petraeus, they certainly were lowering the bar in terms of expectation. That seems to be the theme, if there's anything that you could capitalize out of both Petraeus and Crocker's testimony.
Well, that's what they were trying to do. That's not what I heard the Congress trying to do. I compared it in my own mind, thinking back on when I testified up there a year ago, and then they testified right afterwards. And, you know, Petraeus was the conquering hero, about to go off to Gaul or someplace in the Roman Empire and have another victory and march back for parade in Washington. You didn't get that this year. I was amazed, because I was expecting the contrary, to hear criticisms made and hard, tough questions asked in a way I hadn't heard before. I was also struck by three things that Petraeus said. He used a lot of polysyllabic words, and he always said, you know, there's hope, et cetera, et cetera. But the key phrases that kept coming up are the situation is fragile, it is reversible, and there's no light at the end of the tunnel. Now, if that's his main message, then that says we've spent a lot of lives and made no real progress. And I think those are pretty fair assessments as to generalize. What he didn't offer was a lot of the empirical underpinnings on which I think those kinds of judgments are highly justified, maybe even a little optimistic. So this hearing was, in my mind, a sea change in its difference from last year. While they didn't really gore his ox up there, he didn't walk out feeling like Julius Caesar.
Well, I thank you for joining us today in Los Angeles, General Odoman, for your testimony this week prior to the appearance of Petraeus before the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with General William Odom, who's a senior advisor to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was the director of the National Security Agency under President Ronald Reagan, the head of military intelligence, and a senior military assistant to the President's Assistant for National Security Affairs, Zbigniew Brzezinski. And as I mentioned, on April 2nd, he presented testimony advocating a rapid withdrawal of American troops from Iraq to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee prior to General Petraeus' appearance. I'm now speaking with Lawrence O'Donnell, who's an MSNBC senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group. He's also an Emmy Award-winning producer of NBC's The West Wing and a former contributing editor to New York Magazine. And he was also formerly the Democratic Chief of Staff to the United States Senate Committee on Finance and for the United States Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works. Mr. O'Donnell has a new piece out, both in the Huffington Post and in the New York Magazine, which foresees a possible nightmarish, deadlocked Democratic convention in Colorado. It was written as a movie treatment, and pretty cynical, pretty amusing, but cynical. So do you really, Lawrence O'Donnell, really see this as the portent of a bloodletting in Denver?
Well, it could be. I tried to write it with a mix of realism and some Actually, I wouldn't say cynicism. What other people think of as cynicism in politics, I think of as realism. But realism and comedy, and I was really working with these characters, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, in a way as fictional characters, because New York Magazine asked me to imagine what would happen at a deadlocked convention and then to write it in movie treatment form, which is right away to say we're doing a semi-serious venture here, semi-serious at best. And so I had a lot of fun with it, and the reader should have fun with it. And the one thing that I do take seriously in the piece is the is how we get to the outcome of having an Obama-Wesley Clark ticket. I predicted about a year ago on the McLaughlin Group that Wesley Clark would be the vice presidential nominee no matter who the nominee was at the time, assuming it was going to be Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. Wesley Clark is a very strong Hillary Clinton supporter. He's also a former general. And just this morning on Meet the Press, we finally had the first echo effect of me raising the Clark possibility a year ago, and that's when Bob Schrum on Meet the Press today said that Wesley Clark was a likely choice for Barack Obama because it has suddenly become conventional wisdom that the Democratic nominee is going to need military experience on the ticket to go against John McCain's military experience. And once you start thinking in that direction, there are names of other generals that come up, but the only one who's been politically tested and knows his way around a campaign is Wesley Clark. And I really do think that he's going to be on the short list for VP, and if I have to bet, I will bet that he actually ends up on the VP slot and the Democratic ticket.
So he's the only thing that you can say that's certain about this race. He's got both bases covered, rather.
Right. I found predicting vice president much easier than predicting president. I'd always thought that Obama had an edge, mostly because of a thing that Hillary Clinton can do nothing about, which is it has nothing to do with Obama, and that is Hillary's extremely high negative. She has the highest negative rating of anyone who's ever run for president, and 48 is where it is and has been for a very long period of time. And all the Republicans would have to do in a general election is drive her negative rating up 2 points. I mean, really at 48, it's almost prohibitive in a general election for a candidate to win. And I always thought Hillary's negative, which is much more active outside of the Democratic Party than within the Democratic Party, was going to, in a way, control her performance as a candidate and control the way voters would move to her. And the next biggest thing on the political map when this all started out was Barack Obama. And so I always had, a $1 bet on Obama to win the nomination. I never felt very, very strongly about it, but I always felt that Hillary's negative was going to be the thing that would control the outcome on both the Democratic side and then finally into the general election.
But if that's the dynamic where Hillary, because of her negatives, could perhaps eke out a very narrow victory, but it'd be a nail-biter, what's the landscape for Obama? It seems to me that it's either going to be a big win or he's going to get eaten alive. I'm not sure which of those two scenarios.
I don't think we live in the world of the big win anymore, unless something goes drastically wrong with the McCain campaign, which I think is possible. But I've always said that it's the worst time to be a Republican since 1976. In 1976, Jimmy Carter didn't win. It's just that the Republicans couldn't win. That's what happened. And it's a little bit like 1996. It didn't matter who the Republicans nominated in 1996. Bill Clinton was going to win his reelection. They went with Bob Dole, and everyone said, oh, gee, that's a conventional choice, and you're just doing it because it's his turn. But the other reason they did it is that they didn't have anyone better. And Dole never had a chance. We used to, in TV commentary at the time, try to pretend that there was a race going on there. I remember there came a poll one day in the early weeks of MSNBC being on the air, and Bob Dole had closed to within 18 points. And so we rushed out onto the air to pretend suddenly there was a campaign underway here. This is one of those years where it's really tough to be a Republican. You run with the Iraq war on your back. You run with the bad economy on your back. You run with Bush's disapproval ratings, just a horrible burden for the Republican. But I think we've divided on enough issues in the breadbasket of political issues to create a kind of a permanent firewall of you know, somewhere around 48-47% of the vote for either side. I think a big loss for McCain would be getting 47% of the vote, and you know, Obama would say 53-52, something like that.
Well, it does seem in many ways that that McCain is kind of Bob Dole without a sense of humor. But he's been helped by Hillary, oddly enough, when she suggested that both McCain and her would be more suitable stewards for national security and more qualified to be commander-in-chief. And in doing so, she seems to me that she took off the table one of McCain's vulnerabilities, which is that a lot of generals think he's a hothead and don't want him anywhere near the button. So do you think there'll be an examination of McCain's qualifications here? Or is he just going to get anointed as the...
No, I think his basic qualifications for president won't really be in question. His problem is going to be his policies. His problem is going to be what can be... caricatured as his 100-year war in Iraq plan, and you know, he's just said a bunch of things. I mean, if you could pick one thing that is the single worst thing a candidate has said in this campaign, from, you know, Obama's misstep about, you know, Middle America this week to Hillary's misstatement about Bosnia. And by the way, Ian, have you ever made a misstatement? Because I never have. I have lied. I have said things that I know not to be true. I have misrepresented things. I have deliberately obscured things, not publicly, but, you know, in the course of regular life. I don't ever remember saying to a relative of mine, oh, I'm sorry about that misstatement. You were right. I was wrong. It's the funniest thing whenever campaigns get to the point of having to call what they've done a misstatement. But of all of those things that have been said in this campaign, there is, if you're a campaign manager, there is nothing more difficult to deal with than McCain's reference to 100 years in Iraq. And we can spend the rest of the year debating whether he meant all-out war or whether he meant 100 years in Iraq in a way similar to our half century in Germany that we've now spent. But it's an incredibly devastating comment to be dragging forward through this campaign. And so McCain actually has the capacity, so far as a candidate, more than any of the rest of them, to say things that are directly relevant to future issues that are a serious problem. Because after all, Hillary's Bosnia thing, it's just it's just an untruth about the past. And it has nothing to do with her future Bosnia policy, her future tax policy, or her future Iraq policy. You know, what Obama said this week has nothing to do with how he's going to finance Social Security or how he's going to finance Medicare or what his plan for withdrawal from Iraq is. McCain's 100 years in Iraq comment actually has something to do with how he sees the future and the future American government role in Iraq, and it is a deadly difficult problem for him to deal with.
And indeed, Lawrence O'Donnell, the kindest thing you can say about that misstatement of his is that, you know, he's more or less saying, well, it's going to be Iraq's going to be more like Korea than Vietnam. The idea that Iraq is not like Vietnam, I think, is pretty hard to justify. Just to get back though to the piece you've got in the Huffington Post and in the New York Magazine, I recall that wonderful movie that Gore Vidal wrote. I think it was called The Best Man, was it not?
Yes. Yeah.
Is there some elements of that in your treatment? At least in terms of the behind the scenes stuff that goes on there.
It turns out that political procedurals as dramas are have to work in a relatively narrow range of possibility, just like police procedurals do. You know, when you watch an episode of Law and Order and you think, gee, this is a little familiar to what I saw in CSI last night, well, That's because there's a limited range of choice for police officers to make under any circumstance. And so once you get into the whole convention drama thing, you know, we did one on the second last year of the West Wing. We had a deadlocked Democratic convention that I think, as I can't quite remember how we did it, we went to about three ballots and emerged with our nominee through all sorts of backstage maneuvering and all of that. It will always, once you sit down to write one of these, it will always echo differently. The fun thing about doing it for New York Magazine and the way they requested it was that you're watching real characters in these scenes. You're watching Barack Obama close the door and be alone in a room with Hillary Clinton for a big showdown scene on how they're going to do this. And it is a work of fiction in the same way that any of those other screenplays we might talk about are. But there's a sensation of reality to it because you're hearing the lines coming from these real characters.
Well, what do you think, though? I mean, I know that it's hazardous to predict, and obviously your scenario for this bloodletting, which implies that the bloodletting will continue through the summer all the way to the August convention. We've got the April the 22nd coming up, the Pennsylvania. There are three possibilities there, and we know that Obama's at a disadvantage because it's more of a state that favors Hillary's demographics, but he is getting enormous numbers of students at these rallies. One there was, I saw a picture of 20,000 kids. I mean, when was the last time you could get 20,000 kids on a campus to do anything? I mean, that's pretty extraordinary. So there's an outside chance he could win, which I would think that would basically put her out of business. And then if she won narrowly, do you think that she could sort of go out on a victory, or is she going to fight it out to the bitter end?
No, I don't expect her to go out before the convention. And I do expect her to win Pennsylvania. And the question is, does she do it in single digits or double digits? She had a 20-point lead there recently, and if Obama closes that down to within single digits, I mean, even 9 points, the professional Democrats are going to, who don't already think it's over, because most of them do, including Hillary supporters that I talked to, professional Hillary supporters.
You're talking about superdelegates, right?
Yes, most of them think it's over. And however, if Obama closes within single digits in Pennsylvania, after weathering all the storms of Pennsylvania, which begin with the Reverend Wright, who now seems like a distant controversy, and then this most recent controversy about what Obama said about why people cling to religion and guns and such things. You know, if he weathers all of that and closes within single digits, then professional Democrats are going to be pretty much unanimous that this is all over. And that will actually, in many ways, calm them down, because they will see how strong Obama is, and they will know that he can win this on his own, in effect, by beating Hillary in North Carolina and other states, and that they don't really have to be banging on Hillary's door telling her to step up or asking her to step up. So now, if Hillary wins double digits, you know, 10, 12 points, that will just keep us in the current status quo, which means she doesn't really gain any ground in the delegate count, and we go on to another state, North Carolina, where Obama's going to win decisively and get one of those big Obama wins headlines. I would caution you about one thing, Ian. I know you know this, and I think the audience is onto it by now, too, which is that the Obama rally is not necessarily an indicator of where this thing is going. I mean, I saw the Obama rallies, the Obama appearances in New Hampshire. His crowds were more than double anyone else, more than double Bill and Hillary Clinton put together at an event. He came up short in the vote. We saw it in California. We saw it in Los Angeles at UCLA, an Obama crowd that Obama didn't even show up for, that was, you know, Michelle Obama, joined by the governor's wife and others, Caroline Kennedy, gigantic crowd that the Clinton campaign could not reproduce anywhere in the country, anywhere. He still lost California by a sizable number. You know, I think he does have the most energetic crowds, incomparably energetic crowds, more so than we've seen since Robert Kennedy ran for president. But they don't necessarily indicate which way the state's going to end up.
Hmm. Well, just in closing then, Lawrence O'Donnell, you know, one of the jokes in Hollywood is that studio executive gets a script and says, this is the best script I've ever read. I can't wait to do a rewrite.
Right.
So what about a rewrite in terms of your predictions vis-a-vis Wesley Clark being a shoo-in on either ticket? What about Chuck Hagel?
Oh, I don't think they'll do anything exotic. Remember, the Democratic nominee, Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, and I'm with the conventional wisdom that it will be Barack Obama, either one of them is going to be the most exotic presidential nominee we've ever had in either party. The second person on the ticket has to live within the conventional realm of choice. Political parties, these monopolistic, duopolistic, gigantic political parties, do not live on adventurous choices. The Geraldine Ferraro choice, which was the most adventurous choice ever made, was considered disastrous. And so you won't see them reach across party into somebody like Hagel, something exotic and daring like that. The nominee is going to be exotic and daring enough.
I see. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And, I enjoyed your piece. Again, it's at the Huffington Post and in New York Magazine. Lawrence O'Donnell, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Lawrence O'Donnell, MSNBC senior political analyst and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group. He's also an award-winning Emmy award-winning producer for NBC's The West Wing. And he is a piece that's now on the Huffington Post and in New York Magazine, and a humorous movie script on a nightmarish, deadlocked Democratic convention in Colorado. I'm now speaking with Judith Todd, who's a human rights activist and author, who was born and raised in what is now Zimbabwe, and she became a heroine of the struggle to liberate Rhodesia from the minority rule of white supremacist Ian Smith. And for her efforts, she was jailed by Smith in 1972 and then forced out of the country to spend 8 years in exile in England. She returned to Zimbabwe shortly before independence, was achieved in 1980, and had a front row view from her position as director of an international aid agency to the disaster that Robert Mugabe's regime became. The Economist picked her new book as a book of the year, Through the Darkness, A Life in Zimbabwe, which is available at Amazon.com. And I'm speaking to Judith now from South Africa, where she was forced into exile, punished and stripped of her citizenship by the extraordinarily vengeful Robert Mugabe for speaking out about the regime's abuses of power. And at this point, you would think, Judith, that everybody knows the true face of Robert Mugabe. So why is it that the South African leader, Thabo Mbeki, referred to the situation in Zimbabwe, quoting, "I wouldn't describe it as a crisis. It's a normal electoral process in Zimbabwe."
I think President Mbeki is actually flinching from reality because it's almost too awful to contemplate. It is a normal electoral process in Zimbabwe and has been really since 1985, if not earlier, to use violence and to rig elections. And just before you rang me just now, I've been speaking to a friend from home, and in Harare today, 29 people have been admitted to a private clinic in Harare, victims of Mugabe's violence. It's happening right through the country.
And this is violence perpetrated by alleged war veterans, who are all of whom are very young, too young to have fought in the War of Liberation. And essentially, I imagine what's happening there with all that unemployment, it's pretty easy to pay a few, pay a little money to a bunch of street thugs and get them out.
You've hit the nail on the head. And also, they're putting their youth militia into police uniforms, so they look like police, but they're not. But it's really very, very, very serious now, because true to form, Mugabe is now punishing those who voted against him, or who he thinks voted against him. And, you know, there's no one to protect them. And the SADC leaders have asked President Mbeki to continue as their facilitator of talks with Mugabe, when in fact Mugabe is now a coup leader. There has been a coup.
Well, the forum you're talking about is the forum that was hosted by Zambia's president, who said at this forum, which Mugabe boycotted, but the opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai did appear there. And the host country leader said it can no longer stand by and do nothing when one of its members is experiencing political and economic difficulties. So that's his statement. He also earlier said that he likened the country to a sinking ship. Again, what's being said in South Africa in the media about this apparent denial on the part of South Africa's leader? Are others sharing this denial? What about the leader in waiting, Jacob Zuma?
Well, it's been very interesting. I've been in South Africa on and off for the last 3 or 4 years, and I've been very disheartened up to now with the apparent indifference that the ruling party here, ANC, has been showing to the suffering of the people of Zimbabwe. But this is changing quite fast, and the top 4 people of the ANC National Executive Committee have now come out against, what is happening in Zimbabwe. So, in fact, President Mbeki is painting himself into a very difficult corner. But let me tell you something else I learned today. This process that we've been going through with the election and then the denial of the results and the coup that Mugabe has committed by staying in power has been covered throughout the world. But what's happening now is that those foreign journalists who've been allowed into Zimbabwe to cover the election have been refused to have their accreditation extended. And I'm told today that this is even covering South African journalists. So soon, even South Africa will be switched off from what is happening in Zimbabwe. It is very, very frightening.
And, of course, the opposition leader, who most analysts think won the election, he certainly believes he won by 50.3%, meaning there was no need for a runoff. He's, I think, not going to return because I'm not sure that his safety can be guaranteed.
The safety of no one can be guaranteed, particularly him. And it was very poignant. I've just been watching on South African television pictures of that meeting of heads of state from the region in Lusaka. And the chair for Zimbabwe, with the Zimbabwe flag in front of it, was empty. And, of course, that is where Tsvangirai should have been sitting.
And what was how was he treated by these other heads of state?
I don't know, but what I've read is that he seemed to leave in distress. And I'm just putting two and two together, and that is that as the SADC heads of state have asked Mbeki, who says there is no crisis in Zimbabwe, to continue as their facilitator, that's a very distressing statement. It seems as though even the heads of state from our region are not actually interested that much in the results of elections.
Well, tell me what the man in the street in South Africa feels then, because surely there is no reason for South Africa to want this crisis to continue and in fact to spiral out of control. I've already seen footage, it's just heartbreaking footage of Zimbabweans trying to sneak into South Africa, getting aboard trains and being turned back. And it's so heartbreaking, it almost has echoes of Germany in the 1930s. And I cannot believe that this country and the people in South Africa can be happy about what's happening there.
You see, one of the consequences of the policy of quiet diplomacy meant that particularly the ruling party, African National Congress, was shielded from the reality of what was going on in Zimbabwe. They didn't know, really. I'm giving them an excuse. But the last few weeks, the coverage in the press here and television has been tremendous. And so it's been a great educational experience for South Africa The papers today, Sunday, had photographs all over the front pages of President Mbeki holding hands with her smiling former President Mugabe. I mean, they didn't say that. I'm saying that. Saying there's no crisis. And in the background of those reports was torture, death, farmers being thrown off their land, you know, ZEC not releasing the results. I think that probably South Africa is now waking up and realizing how terribly, cruelly they have been treating their neighbors by just not responding to their cries for help. Maybe something will happen, but now look, as I was telling you, people who are lucky enough to be admitted to a clinic in Harare are being admitted, but there are hundreds apparently throughout the country getting no treatment. Houses being burned, huts being burned. Mugabe is punishing the population of Zimbabwe for voting against him, and no one is coming to their assistance.
And the idea of scapegoating the whites, there's so few of them left, does that give Mugabe any political cover? Because I know that that's been pretty much the theme that they've, in fact, haven't they tried to paint Tsvangirai as an agent of the West?
Yes, they do. And that's what must have made it particularly painful for Mugabe to realize that Tsvangirai beat him hands down. The unofficial results are known. You know, I mean, the results of the election are known. It's just that they haven't been officially announced by the ZEC, and in fact they're busy now rigging the results of the election. But for Mugabe it must have been absolutely maddening to see that people even in his own home area were voting for Tsvangirai and not for him.
And of course he had some major defections from within his own ranks, did he not?
And he did. Mm. I mean, that poor little country, it's just being held at gunpoint now by a very desperate little band of villains who are terrified of justice. But in the meanwhile, their victims are suffering, and there are people who are going to be dead tonight who need not have been dead if Sadek, through Mbeki, was prepared to take action.
Well,
you know, they haven't even reprimanded Mugabe.
Well, but I guess the assumption is, and I'm not sure that it's based on reality, but the assumption is that somewhere in private, Mbeki speaks truth to this man. Do you think that is a wishful thinking on my part?
Well, I would like to join you in your wishful thinking, but if that was happening, I don't think that Mugabe would have been smiling when Mbeki was holding his hand, when the photographs were taken.
Well, then the next possibility is that the South African people, now that they're getting a truer picture through their media, and you've mentioned that the media is going to be shut out along with everybody's, the entire world's media, is there somebody that can light a fire under Mbeki?
Maybe. Yes, I think. I'm sure that, in fact, while you and I hope that President Mbeki is talking the truth to Mugabe in private, I think we can be certain that the ANC is talking the truth to President Mbeki.
You're talking about Jacob Zuma and others.
Yes, and the top executive people in their National Executive Committee. And also, you know, I think what we're going to see is a tightening of ranks between the Congress of South African Trade Unions, for example, and the Zimbabwe Trade Unions. All those kinds of levels, I think people will be trying now to reach across the border and helping. But as I say, Mugabe is now intent on punishing the population of Zimbabwe. He knows that this election rigging that he's going through now will never, never make him legitimate. And so now he's really, you know, he would prefer to kill the country and the people of Zimbabwe than to lose power.
Well, just in closing, then, Judith Todd, what about some of the moral authority of some of the leaders like Archbishop Tutu and Nelson Mandela? Is that likely to be forthcoming?
It's already happened, actually, yes. Particularly, it would be a bit harsh of us to expect former President Mandela to play an active role now, but Tutu is doing whatever he can. And what I'm pinning hope on now is Kikwete, the president of Tanzania, is the chairman of the African Union. And it's rumored in South Africa at the moment that he is now going to call an emergency meeting of the African Union on Zimbabwe. I'm also pinning hope on the new president of Botswana, Seretse Ian Khama, because he's one of that group, actually, who hasn't been forced into a friendship with Mugabe. He's a new president on the block.
Well, I'm afraid...
He has reason for hope.
I thank you so much for joining us. I'm afraid we're running out of time, Judith Todd, but thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Judith Todd, who's a human rights activist and author. She was born and raised in what's now Zimbabwe. She was a heroine of the struggle to liberate Rhodesia from the white minority rule, and she was jailed by Ian Smith and forced into exile, but then came back and then saw the abuses that Robert Mugabe regime turned into a predatory regime, and she's written a book about that, which The Economist picked as a book of the year, Through the Darkness, A Life in Zimbabwe. And I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Lick Duan, the assistant producer, and Nadia Richardson, the engineer.